Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. This is the Rhetoric Files version, where we interview rhetoricians, typically David Payne. Although I've got a second one I did with John Llewellyn, so maybe we'll start filling out the roster. And this is focused around sort of deep diving on specific topics with rhetoricians to, I don't know, more deeply explore. It's not super prepackaged content. I'm not trying to build this so that it's like a delivered lecture. It's more about us wandering. So that's what we're going to do today. And the Rhetoric Warriors Project, again, I talk to comedians. I talk to the right, which I've been doing quite a bit of lately. And I talk to experts. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, producer, comedian, guy sitting in his chair in Austin, Texas. My guest, once again, Dr. David Payne, rhetoric PhD from Kansas or Iowa?
PhD from Iowa.
Iowa. Which people don't really know, but that was like the program at that time, right?
It was, right.
Yeah. You had all those guys.
I was there at the end of the programness of it. I don't think I was the single-handedly brought it down.
You were the last card that brought that.
It was the end of a tradition. I think I commented before that a number of the great old persons, scholars, were fading into retirement and ill health. So I got to have like the last class from a number of really super people that no longer would anybody know their names. But
right. So who was there? Booth was there, right?
No, Wayne Booth. I forget where Wayne Booth was. Doug Gininger, Donald C. Bryant were the grand old men of the field at the time. And so I got to do a short course with Carol Arnold, another one of those names out of the kind of the, you know, they'd all actually come from Iowa. Pretty much, although their degrees weren't, but many of the faculty had been because it just, you're sort of a second generation and somewhat inbred in that regard, but certainly you were instructed in the company line.
Well, and they were heavily
in terms of the history of this thing.
Right. They were heavily into actual speech, right? They sort of looked at speeches and that was their tradition.
Well, that was an older tradition speech criticism. But they were very much into rhetorical theory and rhetorical history. And the program was structured around, I think the opening speech to me was, we have five periods and we want you to take a class in each of the periods.
Yeah. So. Okay. That is. Yeah.
So we got kind of the survey course and I really didn't like it much at the time, but have, you know, learned to value that more and more as you get distant from from the rest of it. I have access to some stuff that otherwise I probably wouldn't have.
Well, in some ways, I think that's a good approach to education. Like everybody wants to start with the foundations first. But those are the boring things, like, and let people wander into the more exotic, the fantastical stuff to look at and then go, oh, I need stuff. And then they want to go back into the foundations because there's so much there.
Right. Well, that was certainly the idea that, you didn't just explore individual topics to get a PhD was to have this sort of comprehensive exposure to all of this. That was the idea. So
you got it. You're foundationed and fantastical.
I got some version of it anyway. Yeah.
Topic this week is loosely propaganda. And I'll tell you where this comes from. Like I said, I've been doing more sort of delving into the right. I've been doing more converting conservative podcasts lately. And there's a guy that I talked to three different times, Dan from Seattle. Really great guy. Really, you know, sharp in what he does. But he's become Borg, you know, he's gotten absorbed. And I try to get in and do a little bit of working on the architecture, the infrastructure inside their heads, because it's so incomplete. It's so half of the Death Star that I ended that with, hey, you know, here's, I only want to get three ideas into your head today, which is the simulacrum means that you're getting bad information. You're a smart guy, which means you rely too much on your own brain to defend itself. And you are potentially wrong on the back end. I said, not telling you this is true. I'm just saying this is something to look at as an architecture. And he came back with, well, what does propaganda look like? Like, can we go through, can you pick something? Because we were talking about the Chauvin trial and we were talking about Matt Gaetz and a couple of the other, you know, issues that have been propagandized. He goes, what does it look like? Can you show it to me? And so I'm like, propaganda is slippery, but yeah, I can do that with you. I can show you what I consider to be one of the major chapters in the unethical playbook and try to illuminate it to the point where you can see it. Because most people don't get enough training, enough background architecture and, you know, linguistic infrastructure to even be able to see it. And so that's where I started with, like, if you look, this is kind of propaganda 2.0. So the digital sphere has upped the production game, allowed propagandists to come, you know, to move away from that kind of Hitler, big authoritarian, blocky kind of tradition and meld with the pop culture and all the things that are normalized in the aesthetic now.
With the caveat there, we do have Trump rallies and we do have lots of films, you know, the Morning in America kind of. So in a way, I'm not sure how far we've moved. We've certainly blossomed them into more ordinary discourse when at one time that seemed rare and exotic.
So. Yeah. And I think, you know, when he did that, when Trump would come up and the journalists would struggle for a way of explaining it and saying, you know, it's like a dear leader. And they would refer back to Mao and, you know, China. And nobody knows what that means anymore. I saw a thing about the Yangtze River. I don't know how to say it. And I had to look it up. And it was, I don't know if you remember all that stuff from red, you know, communist propaganda, but him swimming shirtless when he was an older guy, they put him shirtless in the Yangtze River and he swam supposedly the entire way, beating all the other younger swimmers. Wow. And that's where that dear leader, that's the origin story of it. And so everybody had to come on and praise how well he swam. And it ties right into Putin shirtless. And
all I was going to say, I'm aware of the shirtless tiger hunting Putin. Yeah.
So there's that easily, you know, recognized big clumsy world like that. And then it goes all the way down into this sort of very submerged, hard to find, you know, digital propaganda. But when you look at this, like when your background isn't like, how much propaganda stuff did you teach or did you, you know, track or?
Well, this is an opportunity, and I'm happy that for you to educate me into how you're making that term useful, and maybe together rehabilitate it somewhat. I think UTA for the persuasion course, and as we talked about with education last time, the textbook was primarily to reduce every theory of advertising, every theory of influence, down to a page and a half. And so that people were getting lots of terminology for the same stuff from these different kinds of points of view. And I confess I found the propaganda in some ways the hardest to teach because the materials out there, and if you Google them, you'll still see all of these things, are really, they're really very basic and right. Are come from, a fairly naive point of view when they sort of say, okay, this is deceptive communication. This is, communication that influences this. And a lot of the examples. So they'll say that the techniques from the, you know, International Propaganda Association, I don't know what year it was, the 20s or something, but the term kind of seemed to come alive with mass mediated things, although pamphleting could be propaganda as well. Glittering generalities, wisdom of the rustic, these things are all true of folklore. They're true of any political speech. They're not And so to use such a severe term as propaganda to talk about what's really kind of ordinary composed discourse seemed a little clunky. I mean,
yeah, for sure. I agree. With that.
You know, and we do use it as a very dyslogistic term to you know, like rhetoric is often used to say that it's somehow bad stuff. And so those kinds of basic strategies are, you know, pretty common. Now, if somebody, you know, there are people that don't know that. There's a huge chunk of people. So this is also back to our discussion of education. What do you do with the folks who are simply unaware that all of that goes on? You would want to know those things. But there's nothing theoretical in that description of how these things work that is
right.
special. Yet at the same time, I think we reserve propaganda for labeling, you know, systematic attempts to me, it suggests that these stories are out there, these images are out there living a life of their own. They're propagating through the mass media. And that's kind of the general strategy. And I guess that gets back to the one other criterion that is that the sources are often concealed. We don't know who starts these things.
Right.
Even though that would also be true of folklore or rumor or something else.
Yeah, and I think it's a good place to start. The word propaganda and the history of that, you know, the study of it, it amazes me that like glittering generality seems to be the one that people can remember. And it's a tactic list, like you said, that's not very specific and it's not very...
the bandwagon effect.
Yeah.
This is great for teaching because any commercial or almost any... political campaign will illustrate these things daily.
Right. But that doesn't make it propaganda, right? Like when you start to look down into the elements of defining propaganda itself, I mean, you start with sort of source, right? Most of the sources of propaganda are national governments.
Yeah, our state actors, political factions of some sort or another, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not done by businesses. Like advertising is done by businesses.
Right.
Propaganda, if we're trying to get some kind of definitional borders around it, is done by state apparatus.
Okay.
I mean, that. Do you agree with that? Like, would that make a sensible limit?
I don't want to. I'll go with it. And I think that's the instinct. I think there are probably propagandists working out there. I mean, they are working through the state political systems, maybe. They're not necessarily in the government. For me, the government stuff is ideology, and propaganda is one of the things that, you know, that we would associate with the state. But I think there may be propaganda that's, you know, that serves certain political interests. Certainly, that's kind of the way we're treating if you're on one side of a faction or another side,
I get this,
the other side of propaganda.
When I talk to the right, this is one of the, again, sort of mega lessons that I repeat over and over again to try to get into their heads, the idea of false equivalencies. But so much of this within propaganda, so much of what the right does defending itself and kind of unsettling the cognitive landscape when they, you know, talk to their herd is to create false equivalencies. And you're seeing it right now. Maxine Walters came out and said, you know, be more confrontational if the Chauvin trial, you know, goes the wrong way. And they've taken confrontational, you know, as some type of incitement to riot. And I literally had, you know, a righty do this false equivalency to me yesterday, saying, how is that different than Donald Trump, you know, telling people to go and peacefully protest at the Capitol? She's incurring, you know, people to go out Black Lives Matter to burn down. And I'm like, well, that's an amazing false equivalency. So let's take it apart and see if we can find where it's false or where it's not. But this idea of them skewing logic to the point where people cannot see the difference between a false equivalency and an acceptable equivalency. And okay. I'm running into this constantly in the cognitive schemata of the right.
Well, okay, just once again to make it a little problematic, and then we can move on if need be. But when Trump was president, he was the state. And before that, he wasn't. And after that, he's technically not. Is propaganda different because he was, right? And I think he was largely endorsed because he was still seen as a counter-propagandist or still seen as countering the propaganda of the state. The whole accusation of the deep state is calling out the right. propaganda. We can't believe anything the government says is sort of key to, and so that is itself a kind of an embodiment of that. But then what about the, you know, the sock puppet Facebook robots of the Russians peppering our, you know, media with those kinds of images and stories? Is that not also propaganda? It comes out of their propaganda playbook, right?
Right.
It's their state, but it's, you know, so yeah, I guess so that's still, that's the only way to qualify it.
Right. So, I mean, I think your distinction between the government and the political system is useful. They're both doing propaganda at some level, you know, depending on what, on how much they sanction that. And just the word propaganda itself becomes a real problem for, again, non-rhetoricians, in that they're like, well, everything's propaganda. I'm like, well, that's not true. If we want to limit it, you know, and define it and get some control over it, then we have to do that. It just hasn't been done for them. So they don't understand the term. They don't understand the terms of rationality, like the anchor points that keep things from going into skewed or pseudo rationality. So almost all of them are operating on really strong pseudo rationality axes. And so I'm challenged to go in and what do you do with that? How do you clean that up? And one of the ways is you find these little supercharged pill terms like propaganda and spend some time with it, you know, with them. And so I think this one about, you know, they all want to say, well, the left does propaganda too. And I'm like, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
And I tell them why, that it's, you know, if you define propaganda as at its nature, not going for truth, but literally trying to build anti-truth. I think the left has hitched its wagon to a humanistic, intellectualized version of the world that values truth. Now, whether they get there or not is a wholly different story, but they've hitched their wagon to it, whereas the right has hitched their wagon to anti-truth.
So its nature is propaganda in that construction, the moral purpose behind it. So it is clearly just an invective against, you know, saying that this is unethical. I'm reminded of the old argument about sophistry. Well, the sophist and the ethical persuader use the same techniques. It's a matter of their moral purpose. I think that's Aristotle's line. We can't distinguish there this way. So it's a matter of their moral purpose and the truth content of the, right.
Right, the technique can do either.
So remember in our very first talk, where I used the example of them changing the imagery on the land management from a pile of coal in the Trump's administration to a pastoral flowing river. So if Biden does that, that's not propaganda, even though he's propagating an image out there that is supposed to make us emotionally charged in some way, because it has a noble purpose and
right.
evokes what we would want the real function of this institution to be rather than.
Yeah, it's a humanistic goal, right? It's a laudable humanistic goal. It's not a, you know, which I try to, try to tell everybody, like, my major metaphor for all this is squid nest, you know, that trying to detangle people's rhetoric these days, what they've absorbed, and get back to some of the principles of like clarity and truth and singularity that allow you to do discussions and make decisions. It's really hard because almost, especially on the right, they've tangled so much of their beliefs that detangling it is just arduous. I mean, picking one little thing, that's why the guy, you know, from Dan from Seattle literally say, can you give me one thing to work through? Because I was blowing his head apart with taking too many things that he believed and, you know, putting him through some type of rhetorical wood chipper.
Well, it does become problematic when, you know, you make it, you sort of fly against the partisan conflict that way. Indulge me for a second. Thinking that we're going to talk today, Stephen Colbert made a joke last night. Okay, and you're the comic, so I'll throw this one to you.
It's going to be a good joke. He basically only does good jokes. He's a good writer.
Well, so this was about Obama apparently hosting a special where he had, at least in the clip that Colbert showed, prominent Black people saying we need to take the vaccine, and it was targeting communities of color that might be resistant for whatever historical purposes, right? That's well, you know, talked about these days. That they don't trust the government in general, they don't trust the white dominated society in general, and the Tuskegee experience and all of that. So it was an attempt to kind of overcome it for those specific populations. Anyway, and Colbert says, you know, the special might be missing.
Don't turn your face too far from the mic.
I was trying to read it accurately. Okay, yeah. Yes. That it might be missing the right groups because they had surveyed white Christian evangelists and Republicans, and 30% of each group were saying that they would not get the vaccine. And his joke was saying, I guess the message that the vaccine is safe and effective is harder to assimilate than the idea that Hugo Chavez and a cabal of pedophile celebrities have stolen the election from the least popular president in history in a plot that can only be understood by a man clutching his own pillow.
Yeah, great joke.
But it gets at the, if you don't believe what the government says because the government's saying it, right?
Yeah.
Yet you have these far-fetched, I guess, to compound that, I've been watching the HBO special on QAnon, which I haven't gotten all the way through it yet. But once again, you're talking about the entanglements of these disbeliefs that are circulating in and through these media, comprising, you know, it's something like an ideology, with actors who are doing sort of intentional, what we might call propagandizing.
Right. So,
anyway, that schism between, if you just teach people to suspect the government, as we've explored before, you wind up in this kind of cynicism where these alternative sources of truth are not held suspect in the same way. In fact, they achieve credibility. My one Trump confidant argued at some length that, well, Joe Biden's not authentic. He's manufactured here out of the system in the state. Whereas Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, when everybody was saying, God, she's nuts because she believes Jewish lasers caused these fires, they're saying, but that's authentic. And therefore, there's a truth quality to it. So anyway, it's back to the source problem here.
Yeah, and it, you know, when people see artifice, they see construction on the messaging. You know, that's probably part of the problem of rhetoric. They indict it.
It's composed. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. But now that I know that, I can't trust it. Right?
Well, it's the same way people find out that stand-up comedy, like I write stand-up comedy for people they see on TV.
Right.
I used to also write daily jokes for morning radio guys who would say my jokes, and they sound very clever in the moment because it's all sitting in front of them pre-written. And so that pre-writtenness, that pre-artifice, but again, people want to pick that up and move it over onto rhetoric, or they want to indict the whole thing and sort of throw it all out, baby with the bathwater, and therefore I can't trust anything.
Right.
I think rhetoricians haven't done a good job. Again, so the Rhetoric Warriors project is to take all this stuff as much as I can, take it out into the real world and see if I can explain it to people so they see the value in having a critical apparatus in this world, you know? And so we have to explain why when I talk about something as propaganda and I tell people, okay, the right operates on propaganda. And they're like, what does that mean? And they want to argue, so is the left. I'm like, no, it doesn't.
Okay.
They both operate on influence, sometimes artificial influence, sometimes unethical influence or whatever. But the right has opened wide like a snake mouth and swallowed the ostrich egg of propaganda. And they use
I see what you mean about the problem of false equivalency, that it is a kind of an armor against this analysis.
Yeah, it dismisses everything.
And it's back to the most basic form of that is that this guy's lying. Well, they all lie.
Yeah.
Right. Therefore, we seek some other source of truth or some greater truth or some, right. As in the case of QAnon, some coded truth that's being tapped into some unlikely.
Yeah, and which can't be disproven.
Yeah, I think maybe that's a good one to put on the list when you rewrite the textbook. Is that it tends to explore forms of messaging that do not subject them to truth or false scrutiny. Disprove these things.
You know, they get interlaced with logic, but they're story forms. And I tell people all the time, like the QAnon is just a much better story. It's got supervillains. It's got hidden mysteries, and we've been trained to that. How many movies have you seen that are very similar to that? Some type of hidden evil. That's all science fiction. You know, we've been trained to that story format. So it's real easy to move over to conspiracy thinking in this culture.
Right. And image becomes another resource. I think I think technology has a lot to do with it. And I think of Jacques Ellul's analysis that focuses on propaganda. I recall one of the stories from one of Ronald Reagan's media guys. I guess the story in the newspaper that was written that day was about them doing union busting of some sort or another. But the picture that they got it printed was of Ronald Reagan drinking a beer with the guys down at the union hall. And he said, we didn't need to worry about the story because the picture is all that people would look at, right? Here he is, the old uncle with the boys, the working class hero.
It back to the Putin shirtless Putin. You still remember it?
Sure.
Easy. I don't know anything.
Right. That is true. I still remember that example. That's right.
I know nothing about the guy, really. I know vague stories, and the word oligarch has kind of stuck with him a little bit for me. But I know nothing about him other than that. But I've got that image.
Poison's journalist, I guess, would be that.
So when you think about, if your goal as the rhetorician was to teach people to protect themselves from propaganda, what are some of the things that you would haul out?
Well, I was hoping to ask you that because you're writing the textbook, sort of reinvigorating the word for me. Like I said, I always had trouble from my own biases, I guess. But I do think the things that we've identified that things that you don't know the source of. So being scrutinizing sources, I think, would be pretty elementary. That there are stories, there are images, there are rumors, there are, you know, things circulating out there. And I think that the naive consumer believes because it is circulating out there that it has greater truth. And where they hear it at the water cooler, they hear it from the cousin, you know. And in that, it shares a resemblance to urban folklore. And I always would teach also a unit on urban folklore because it has that same kind of characteristics, the fact that it's told to somebody in an non-institutional channel.
Right.
And so I think one of the strategies of propaganda is to access those channels, which we're seeing, you know, writ complex in the kind of the Facebook technologies of where we can, you know, we can echo that same message over and over again thousands of times with computers and make it seem as though it is in part of the environment. And once again, when challenged to ask, how do some of these, you know, why is the guy, the inventor of a pillow company, a spokesperson of truth at the Republican convention? And why is, you know, the idea that celebrities and liberals eat babies held by a more than frightening percentage of the population? It has to be that kind of environment, you know, almost populating and furnishing the world with these kinds of images. So I think that not knowing the source of these things, disguised sources would be a criterion.
Let's talk about that one a little bit.
And I think state sponsored propaganda certainly is, you know. But once again, you don't want to make the state dysfunctional and keep these other things alive.
Well, and it's become not just the state, it's the, you know, it's the state, it's the political apparatus, but it's also the connection to the intellectual apparatus, the think tanks, the, you know, ideology coming from the sort of powerful cabals of the Koch brothers and stuff like that from behind the scenes. And one of the things I try to, it's another image that I can get into people's minds a little bit, is top-down monolithic communication builds. And so this idea that the right, if you go back to the Powell Doctrine in 1971, where Supreme Court Justice Powell wrote a paper basically saying the right's going to lose unless they create an messaging infrastructure, because universities are all humanist and intellectual and and we don't have that stuff. So it literally laid this out of fund, you know, get money and fund think tanks to generate positions and to attack the left's positions, and then, you know, get media to where you can distribute those things. So you have the Sinclair Broadcasting, you have the Fox, you have the, they started with AM radio because it was so cheap and there was no competition there. And then that becomes handed down to the herd. And so when, one of the other ways I try to deconstruct the right when I can do conversions on them is that they're carrying around scripts that they did not create and they don't know where they came from. Like, I can pull out exact scripts and words and, you know, exact lines that they're all saying. I'm like, well, where did you learn that? Like, this guy kept hitting me with that. We started on this topic of whether Trump's a racist. He gets accused of being a white supremacist supporter, a racist, and all this stuff. And he's like, well, there's 38 instances, there's clips of 38 times when he's disavowed white supremacy. And I'm like, you have never watched all those things and you did not put those clips together, and you are hitting me with this number 38 because you feel like it's overwhelming. All that,
and there's there's no context being 38 times the press forced him to disavow it after hemming and hawing at great length.
There's also, so I'm like, all that has been handed to you prepackaged as an argument.
Right.
And you're just using it, which means you've been used by the monolithic system all the way down. Same way, like the Catholic Church, you know, at one point at least had the power for the Pope and the papacy and the bishops to come up with positions, hand it out throughout the whole world. And then it goes into, you know, the pulpits and the herd hears it.
And I mean, I like that. And it sort of encounters the same difficulty. What I'm hearing is not just the sort of the concealed source part of it and the circulated part of it, but also that there's kind of an organization behind it. It's more than just tactical. It is strategic and part of a coherent. So you're talking about it as conspiratorial in a way.
No, I'm just talking about it as organized. And that's what they always want to say, like, well, doesn't the left do the same thing? I'm like, no. I said, it's just organized communication, which in propaganda terms is great. The state can do all that stuff, but in human reception terms is dangerous. It can do
good distinction. Too much power. But the whataboutism is conspiratorial. Well, yeah, this is what everybody does.
I'm like, they have handed that to you, that false equivalency again, that overgeneralized conclusion, you know, as a fallacy. They've handed that to you as a, you know, an attack.
Well, and I think that is something that on the street kind of wisdom and analysis and journalism has not done much to expose. The sources and the think tanks and their allegiances and where they're funded, one can trace this back to. So that is a story not often told. It just sort of appears as, you know, the nightly report.
And I don't know if you've ever actually read any of the output that that think tanks put together, like the right, especially the think tanks, they are incredibly detailed. They'll put out a 75-page report about, you know, what to say about the Chauvin trial if it goes this way versus this way versus this way. And it's all the way down to scripts, like exact lines. And that's why I say, like, it's a monolithic, very organized, high-powered communication infrastructure, sure. Which, you know, it's dangerous if you just allow that to operate without people being able to see into it and to know that it's there. And the right, the whole herd doesn't know it's there.
Yeah, an example I think that we've only heard little rumblings about is the massive organization behind that has operated for 20 years at least behind getting conservative Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, just knowing the agenda of that architecture, you know, organization, people.
And that organization maybe used Trump as much as vice versa.
Well, I think Trump was a clown who jumped into the Porsche. Like, they built a Porsche and they're ready for Rubio or Cruz or whatever stooges that they had groomed. And no, Trump had way more skills with the media and everything and just jumped into the car and took
right.
it.
Right, but this is the deal that got cut, because I don't believe he's really morally shocked and outraged about abortion. But that was the one promise he made. I mean, he made two big promises that allowed him to get enough support to get elected. One was that he would only choose Supreme Court justices off this particular list come up by that foundation, right? And the second one was that he would give the Republican tax cut, which was Paul Ryan's plan. He was not in favor of that to start with. So he's neither a moral nor a fiscal conservative, but those are the two unequivocal commitments he made to get elected.
Hey, the clown will spray you with whatever seltzer you put in the bottle. They don't they just want to spray.
But once again, I don't think most people, and most certainly not most followers of Trump, realize that he didn't really invent those things. I mean, this is not his platform.
Right. So the question is, if you're dealing with a audience, a herd that likes a simplified explanation or a story-based explanation, what I just did sort of blows their minds. They want to reject it, this idea of the monolithic structure and where it is and all that kind of stuff. And I have a couple of sources, simple sources that can kind of help them see it a little bit better, but they will do everything they can to mentally and cognitively keep this out of their heads, because it's so antithetical to what the, you know, output of that stuff is that they want to live with, the stories. They don't want to believe that their story has been constructed by guys like me back behind the doors writing, you know, stories. Like, I did a podcast, I don't know if you watched any of it, of a buddy of mine who executive produced Worldwide Wrestling for a while. And he wrote the storylines. Who was going to win? Who was going to lose? How was it going to happen? And they had a writer's team coming up with the stuff all the time. And that blows people's minds that it was all that constructed. And QAnon, I promise you, the same thing has happened. There's a writing team somewhere in some right-wing think tank that is filling that story bucket.
Maybe. I mean, that wouldn't shock me to discover that. And I haven't studied it. I haven't ever gone to any of its, you know, so everything I'm seeing is kind of overheard. From the little bit that these two episodes of that documentary have exposed me to, I'm not sure it even has to go to that effort. It seems like one of the things it has going for it is now made you look. So everybody's waiting on it. It's sort of like being there with Chauncey Gardner. The audience is constructing this as they go by their constant attention. And so there's a feedback loop going where that will say something, you know, the QAnon, whoever's doing it, will say something ambiguous. People will respond to it and assign it deep inner meanings. And then it will choose one of those to fan as the next step.
So, yeah.
And so there is this perverse fantasy chaining going on based upon a kind of an immediate audience, you know. It's sort of like fan fiction where you constantly write what the fans are feeding back into it.
Yeah, and that kind of, that's what I talk about with Propaganda 2.0. What happens is you start to get these production structures, these creativity structures like that, like harvesting from a million users and fans for storylines. And sitcoms have done this. They all do it. They all monitor this stuff. A lot of stand-ups have had really great concepts or jokes lifted and then recycled back through some type of story, you know, writer's room and appear on a sitcom. Sure. Because it's such a massive resource to have a million people or whatever thinking about your story. And QAnon's the same exact same thing. And that's when I talk about Propaganda 2.0, it's not, you know, one or two or three Nazis sitting in a room going, what do you think or whatever. It's all this story resource. And when it hits, like there are lots of other conspiracy theories other than QAnon. And he cobbled together a bunch of different elements.
Yeah, it seems to be kind of a gathering place for, it can absorb almost any, you know, it's a meta conspiracy. It can absorb almost any other conspiracy.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, to me that when you look at it, like, how do you deconstruct that? So you've got this super source, like we look at it and go, that's stupid. How can people believe how that, but it's not a cognitive product, it's a story product. And so if you're going to attack it as propaganda and delegitimize it and depower it, you've got to approach it from that perspective. And I find a lot of rhetoricians and cognitivists and liberals, they approach things from the cognitive always. And it's like, you're not even speaking the language that these people have absorbed.
Right. Well, I would speculate or submit that part of that, once again, if part of that is a residual of sort of the journalistic and the rhetorical skepticism about all messaging. And so if you say the government is constantly manufacturing messages to steer you this way, this is kind of the, you know, this is kind of the first naive step to sort of say, oh, gee, I can't believe any of that. So I am susceptible. So the other alternative is, you know, nihilism. I can't believe anything.
Or why isn't it ever, I better get much better at figuring out what to believe.
Well, but that's just it. This is the easy take home kit for getting better. That's the point of it, isn't it? This is the do it yourself at home version of putting together the truth. And I think that the from traditional rhetorical thinking or analysis, the psychology of that is because they're participating in it, because they think they're doing it themselves, that truth is more effective. It is, right? They think that they uncovered this through their own research. They think that watching the QAnon space, and another point made is that people aren't really watching the QAnon space. They're watching the secondary the harvesters that are using that. So very few people go to the original posting site, which is something called 8chan. Because it is so full, it's unmonitored completely. Right. It's full of pornography. It's full of every hideous thing in the world, to where even the guy that started it won't deal with it because it's completely, and how it wound up there was exactly that. Nobody, Reddit had banned QAnon and 4chan had. So it was invented for that purpose, to be completely unrestricted posting. So there's this other group of sites that go harvest the QAnon messaging. Other people don't really see it in its original. So it always comes to you, you know, with a point of view, with a digest, with an instruction kit for interpretation.
Well, it gets moved into consumption messaging, which is what it has to do, like these days. Like,
it takes advantage of a whole different set of technological relationships than sitting at home watching TV messages. If you think about the evolution from propaganda as, here, drop a bunch of handbills on the street or post them on, you know, telephone poles.
Did you know, all the way
to radio and TV.
Did you know that one of the first things that the Nazis did with the propaganda was they handed out radios to everybody, free radios?
Yeah.
Same thing.
And of course, like, America did the same thing, didn't we? With Radio Free Europe, we had to have people to get them. That was part of the counter move, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was the iPhone of its time, right? It was handheld. You could get the stuff from it right there, and it's like, we don't need these pamphlets anymore that nobody wants to read. Now they can just, you know. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that I think that sort of technological opportunism of propaganda is kind of part of what keeps it hidden from people, right? They think they found an alternative source, and then people can use that.
Well, one of the other moves that I find myself needing to make a lot of times when I do the conversions is to get people to question their own ethos. Mm. You know, they've built up this individualism, the power of the individual, you know, which you get fed a lot from the right and libertarians. And it's a basic plank in American society, right? So they've built that up to the point where, and this was my point with Dan from Seattle, you're a smart guy. You know, I've been talking to smart people. They're engineers, they're doctors, these accountants. These are people who are successful in cognitive industries, but they're feeding in bad matter through their cognitive apparatus and getting bad output. So I have to get them to question whether they can take their cognitive training into this kind of environment, this slippery, super produced digital environment, and do any good work. They have to stop relying on themselves, which again, it allows me to at least try to move them over to maybe let me teach you a little rhetoric to protect yourself with so that you can up that ethos. Cause you have zero, like when I tell them, like, you have zero training in rhetoric, formal training at least. Uh-huh. You know, we all do it implicitly. There's an informal learning about messaging. But that's not going to get you in this kind of simulacrum environment. That's not going to protect you. You know, it's so hard to parse a lot of that stuff. Even just you, like, watching, you know, the HBO thing on QAnon and just now picking up a lot of that stuff, even though you're one of the most high-powered trained human beings on the planet in rhetoric.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's just been rumored and dismissed, but not really. One doesn't necessarily want to go down that rabbit hole too quickly, especially in what you know about it. But I'm going to finish the series, and I recommend people do, because once again, once you see the sources, I think you get a whole different picture of this. The people who are actually involved, at least in the technical productions of this, and it's or that's as far as I've gotten with it. Well, I thought as you were talking too about your three curricula with Dan. And it occurred to me to reverse the order of those. If I understood, you said you're smart, you're using your own brain too much, and what was the last one?
The core is you're using your own brain too much. To the left is here's the simulacrum, and to the right is here's the output that's flawed because you've taken it through your brain without any rhetoric training.
And you're wrong was the final one, right?
Yes, you're wrong. That's what I keep telling
you. So what if you reverse those to say, okay, plank one, you're wrong. Two, this is because you're not accessing sufficient information outside your own thinking. So you're trapped in your own, you're isolated, siloed in your own biases here and needs. And three, you're a smart guy, get with it, right? So you can do this. That sounds like a pretty good curriculum to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, the challenge becomes in the digital, you know, the simulacrum it's not just a joke. It's so good at producing itself. And in ways of like this appropriation, this incredibly effective appropriation they've got of take whatever they're accused of in propaganda. And this is in the Putin playbook, is just accuse whatever crime you're accused of, whatever technique you're accused of, just mirror it back and accuse the accusers of doing it. And you see this technique used in incredibly sophisticated ways right now. So this idea that maybe Black Lives Matter or people are going to protest even violently, you know, the verdict is now reflected back onto the Capitol insurrection. And it's like, well, they're just protesting. So, you know, what's the difference?
Right. And the equivalency between, storming the Capitol and brutalizing some policemen and, setting a dumpster fire in Portland. That's tit for tat, which goes nowhere. It just spins the wheels, right?
Right. But is the technique to go in and, you know, talk about, to try to prove a false equivalency, or is the technique to get them to understand what a false equivalency is?
Right.
Like if you go down into the example itself, into the micro, you're lost. If you can keep them at least at mid-cro or macro, where they can see some of the theory, like they can't see the mega kind of theoretics up here. They misuse that. But I think a lot of it is me trying to just keep them above the example itself.
Well, you know, I should step back for a minute and I'm committing the lawyer's fallacy of asking the question you don't know the answer to. But what pops into my head as you're talking is, I recall Alan Greenspan at the end of, you know, the stock market crash or whatever. But his line was something like, people asked him what the number one thing that influenced the stock market was, and his answer was fear. And it seems to me that there's a kind of a bottom line here that it's trust. And so the void that you're running up against here, when you want them to get to that next level of consciousness of not just, you're right, if you just counterexample, oh, that's not the same as this, being even in that sumo wrestling match is a defeat.
Yes.
Even if you push him off the mat, it doesn't matter.
Makes no difference. If you go right into the mosh pit,
you're still fighting the wrong battle.
Yeah.
And so to come up to a level of consciousness to realize that's not really where the conflict is. This is not about this, bit of data or this bit of data. This is about moral purpose. This is about what's healthy. This is about what's likely to be true, and what's functional to be true. Then you've got to get them to trust that. And there's no doubt that as the slide downward into that arena has been mistrust. And the way back is equally fraught. If going up to the election and occasionally listening to, the false equivalencies, that the vehemence with which some people would say, oh, you want dictator? Joe Biden's going to be the dictator. He's going to, and you wonder, where did you get that, that truth?
Right.
It's not easy to destabilize that. I don't know what that place is. What to get them to trust again, rather than.
I'll tell you some of my experience with that, because what I try to do is get them to transfer their trust onto me.
It's kind of
like a psychotherapist.
As a good shrink.
Yeah, right? It's doing some transference. I'm like, so, and they want to transfer their mistrust to me because I have some expertise. I seem, liberal to them. I'm clearly not an adherent to.
And grounded. You have that ethos. You do.
Right. And so I purposefully work on my ethos a lot. In these sessions and when I do this stuff, because I'm like, I tell them directly, I'm like, they'll be like, well, how do I make these decisions about what's true or not? I'm like, well, just listen to me. Like, I will tell you and you can trust me. I said, or, I set my agenda differently. And this is, all this is true. I'm not doing this as deception to try to hide my goals or my techniques or anything else. So I'm like, well, I'm trying to get the world to use ethical techniques over unethical techniques. I don't care about defining those perfectly right now. I care about you talking well. And I worry when you have extracted political positions and life beliefs from a skewed environment that you're probably not qualified to deal with. So I worry about you. And I'm trying to look and say, how can a smart person, good person too, because I know, Dan from Seattle is a really good person and he does great work for people. He's in the medical field and he cares about doing it well and not exploiting people. It's the core of who he is. But then you're voting for Trump Now, to me, that's a scary environment where the good people are voting for the bad people. And that worries me. And so I go in and I'm like, I'm going to give you some techniques to try to take you out of that loop. And so I do transference for sure.
You know, and I guess if one tries to write that as a larger strategy, I don't know what kind of audiences you have access to, but you know, the thing that I hear is you're talking to them in a non-condescending way, which is a special gift that most of the liberal have done neither. They neither talk to the other group or in a non-condescending way. And I think that's been the biggest barrier from at least that side of the fence. There is an equivalency there that probably isn't false, that both sides are to blame for this, but at least on the liberal side, the smug, dismissive, and ignoring, you know, the kinds of psychological needs and what, where do I get my truths and why?
Right.
Why do I rely on them? What is the, and you know, I think basic rhetoric can get you there, that what is the rhetorical vision in this community that of the conservative community? Why, how do they regard, why are they mistrusting? Because I think for the Dans, probably it is, even if you get them fully aware of all the lying, all the, you know, if you, once again, if you're just saying that's not true, you're missing that there is this other truth that's being spoken here that is, which I don't think should be trusted, but the real mystery here is why is it? But it doesn't, they don't have the medium, they don't have the transfer to trust the politicians on the other side, and all of the analysis and tools can start working corrosively against achieving that, right? So it seems to me to bottle what you've got and dispense it gets back to some pretty basic things that you know, time has to be spent. And part of the problem here is these sort of insurmountable obstacles, right? Irreconcilable differences that continue to seem to deepen, where communication can't be, you know, we're just getting along better if we don't talk to each other. Pretty soon we're going to get along better if we don't live next door to each other, right?
Right. Well, and it's one of the reasons why I try, as I've sort of oscillated through this and try to find useful things from rhetoric that can help in this environment. That's why one of the sub programs here is Convert One Conservative. Because if you think of taking on the herd and, you know, doing right, massive repetitions of this kind of work, you're not going to do it. If you focus on one person and really learn them and like the basics of rhetoric, audience analysis, well, what got them here psychologically? You know, what sources have they been listening to? How do I interrupt those sources or add to the sources? And again, all the rhetorical tools, like you said, the basic rhetorical tools will do a lot for people. It's just nobody has been given those in a nice coherent kit of, hey, try this. You know, like the validation, like learning how to validate somebody, whether you can disvalidate, you don't have to validate their worldview or their politics, but you can easily validate the fact that they're trying to figure things out. You know,
do the right thing. Absolutely.
And I hear a lot of times when I talk to Hart did the same thing, and you've done it a couple of times, where I hear politicians say, you know, when I talk to normal people, I know we're all trying to do the same things. So they add an equivalency, you know, and it may not even be a false equivalency, but that the right and the left are both trying to do the same thing, instead of seeing the complete disequivalency between them, that rhetorical move of turning it over and saying, well, let's find the equivalencies between these sides.
Right. Yeah, a different kind of common ground. I mean, you know, are we just going to bicker about what's true, or, you know, are there other forms of common ground?
Yeah.
You know, maybe some sub-department in this effort should be finding those obstacles to cooperation and commonality. I think about the way that we report politics in blue state, red state, you know, and people start thinking in that tropism about, I'm in a red state. And then we start fighting about that as though that were, you know, ignoring the fact that there are millions of Republicans in California and New York. And there are millions of Democrats in, you know, Wyoming, whatever. And so maybe not so many, but we are living together, right? And once again, if we start thinking in terms of these labels, and that's all funneled through something quite abstract in terms of the set of images and semiotics on the media, rather than who do I talk to at the store? I'm pretty sure the gals I talk to at the store checking my groceries that are so friendly, I'll probably vote for Trump. And it's just not an issue, right? So I think maybe part of this is the specialized, unintegrated isolation of our media experiences when we go home and get on our computers or watch the TV, the nightly news or whatever, or watch my Fox News. You know, you're participating in that drama of difference and conflict.
Right. And that is the nature, right, of sticking your head into the simulacrum every night. You know, instead of living in the real world where, like, the de Tocqueville stuff about people are doing politics on a local level and sitting in a meeting and listening to other people talk and how they talk and trying to persuade those people versus trying to persuade somebody on Twitter, you know, the distance between those two experiences on every level, it's informative. Like, if you really do want to change, that's why I do the, you know, convert one conservative. If you want to change somebody, you're going to need a relationship. You're going to need multiple conversations.
Right.
You need all those skill sets of,
anything has to be sustained outside of that environment.
Yeah.
That's the number one conclusion about media doesn't have really any influence unless those things are sustained outside the media environment. But as with, you know, you were talking about the simulacrum, not getting outside the media environment changes that game.
Yeah. Good luck. You know, I go to the gym and people,
right. We're not going to church. We're not going to the marketplace. We're, you know,
one of my favorite things at the gym was I went in once to 24 Hour Fitness and they have 40, you know, TVs everywhere. And somebody had gotten the remote and changed all the TVs to like the PTL, like religious station, and then stolen the remote.
Wow.
I'm like, I don't know that, you know, that's a good Christian, except for, you know, the stealing,
sabotage there. Yeah.
And they do it all the time. They always change, you know, to Fox News when they come in and they leave it there. And it's always odd to me in Austin when I'm working out and see Fox News in front of my face. I'm like, hey, Austin, come on. You know, that should not be even here available in Austin.
Good. Yeah, I don't know who made the joke, but CNN is what you watch at the airport, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, propaganda 2.0 to me is possible because of the digital. Like, if it was coming to us through printed leaflets and maybe even the radio still and all that, then we can protect ourselves from it. When I see smart people, good people being absorbed, I'm like, no, they've got a new inroad. Like, the, you know, the bridges, the shoots into people they're different now, and people don't know how to defend themselves from it.
Sure.
So I hear a lot of this, you know, in Fox. I tell people, it's one of the other stories I tell people about Fox. So here's the claim I start with. Well, Fox is not new. It's a propaganda machine. It's what it's designed to do. And they're like, well, what? And I'm like, no, it was literally inserted by a foreign power. The Rupert Murdoch was Australian. He's not American. Built purposefully to put right-wing propaganda up with the other top three, you know, networks. Reagan allowed it all in, like he made him a citizen and got rid of, you know, all the different, you know, FEC, whatever it is, legislation that would have kept that propaganda off the air. And it's been operating now since, you know, early 1980s. And it's incredibly effective. Now it's moved over into digital. And you don't know how to protect yourself from it because you don't even believe it exists. You think that's news. And you look at the early things that Fox did, you know, rhetorically, which was to equate themselves with news. We're Fox News. We are fair and balanced. You know, they appropriated all that language of journalism as cloak, you know, as nice sheep clothing to get, you know, the wolf of propaganda out into America. And to me, that's the only central explanation I can see for how effective that stuff's been. It's come under that digital, you know, sheep's clothing that is so strong, with draping it in American rhetoric, draping it in journalistic rhetoric, all that kind of stuff. And it's just so potent that people haven't been taught how to protect themselves from
it. I'm not sure how we got to the place where people watch it and watch it exclusively and watch it all the time. I mean, the age of the readership has something to do with it, that there was this sort of lost community of boomers that had lived in the shadow of, the liberal mindset, the blue collar boomer contingent that simply had not been voiced. And I think, you know, it has more to do and is maybe more animated by the next group to come along, the Gen Xers, if you look at voting behavior and if you look at the demographics on Fox. So it may be, you know, there's this just unexploited group there who are making some sort of natural life turn into spending more and more time with political news and whatnot and drama. That this occupied that, and that just became a kind of a self-reinforcing bubble. I think if one were to really story it, going back and looking at the mainstream news people that eventually got into, for whatever reason, Fox, and all of a sudden we find out what their political opinions are. It's kind of a media colonization.
Right. Yeah. It's a colonialism approach to media, you know, to get into that land and create some space and bring in your weaponry and your armies and recruit.
But part of it has been, you know, once again, it sustains itself through this corrosive partisanship that sort of says the other side is trying to, you know, there's where the propaganda is.
Right. And it's again, that's why I said, like, the master trope of, or the master fallacy of false equivalency is just to move all that stuff again into the same pot and not see the differences. And that's one of the challenges, again, I have when I talk to the right is, let me show you why, because they all say, well, the left does the same thing. You know, it's infrastructure. I'm like, no, it doesn't. I said, you show me on CNN where, or, you know, any of the liberal outlets where a think tank has moved a message all the way down through the system and it comes out of Jake Trapper's mouth. Now, Jake Trapper may say similar things to what the think tank started with or whatever, but there's no script. That's not, there's no infrastructure for it like that on the left.
Well, and there's all kinds of other unfortunate cultural things going on in the hatred of Rachel Maddow, right? And the not appreciating the fact that she pretty much proves what she says, right? And you know, that's just writ media, the problem with Hillary Clinton. Smart women and fact-based reality are not quite the all-star wrestling.
Right.
They're the ones we want to hiss, right? Not the ones we want to cheer on, so.
So this is an ongoing issue. I mean, the propaganda world and the power of it and the fact that it's evolved. I sent some sources to you. One of them is this sort of Russian journalist/celebrity who we used to work somehow in the KGB. And she, I remember reading a thing from her on Twitter when she was talking about, you know, you Americans are so fucking stupid. You look at propaganda as if it was still the 1950s and Putin was in the KGB. He is not stupid. Like, they have evolved their propaganda to the level where you cannot see it, you know, and they've got all these techniques. It's evolved just the same way all the rest of the culture has. And you need to get, you know, with it and actually illuminate this stuff and defend yourselves. And that message never gets out, you know, that the stuff that it has evolved, you know, it's not just sat there in big rallies and all that. You still see some of it because it's effective technique with Trump, but, you know, it's not going to just sit there.
Well, probably the ideology of a free society and free press and all of that.
Yeah. You've got all those open doors
to undermine our desire to, you know, to want to go there. And you get back to that same reading of Orwell that, you know, in 1948 and on, that he's really critiquing these communist state-controlled societies where information is contained. And of course, our celebration was always, well, we can all say anything we want to.
Right.
And I think that that ethos is part of what the, you know, the decrying why we can have these radio shock jocks and Fox News people, or not even news people, whatever they are, conspiracy mongers, the QAnons, is that this is once again this constant revelation of the hidden truths. And so that trope all by itself is locked people into a naivete about, and once again, Putin figured out a long time ago, start tinkering with that, right? Interfacing these naturalistic modes of crowd information.
Yeah, I talk about it again. I try to find the simplest metaphors I can to start the conversation. And the idea of, we have now polluted our public discourse streams. And we started with advertising, like all the different things that we dump into the stream, and now high-end propaganda. Like, and then you go, well, that's, you're supposed to learn about people in a democracy so you can make decent decisions about who you vote for. You're going to the same stream, you know, for that information.
And I think that is also part of the problem, is that we, unlike Russia, which has been a propaganda state for, you know, 80 years at least, commerce is our number one thing, making money and shopping. And so advertising has had free reign. Well, most of these techniques, if you really want to, you know, come up with the playbook of propaganda, just follow advertising.
Yeah.
Here, create a relationship. Yeah. Here, product placement. Here, you know, all of those techniques are done by smart people trying to figure out how to use the media to get you to behave, you know, to control your behavior.
Siblings.
Our sort of freedom of the marketplace keeps us from wanting to get too far into that as our expression of freedom. And so our ideology there is kind of working against us, that that's giving something up.
Right. And, you know, when you look at what, like even what we're doing here, fairly high-end intellectualism or academics in a public format that we can now put into the public discourse stream. Like this is not in the public discourse stream. It's in the side, maybe a little side tributaries and things like that, but it never gets what advertising gets. Like, how many Geico commercials have you seen in your life versus how many rhetorician trainings have you accessed in your life? And my whole thing is, like, if we want to continue a democracy and we want to be able to use the public discourse stream, then we'll never depollute it, but at least see the pollutions and be able to distinguish between what is probably pollution and what's trustable. And I think when you pull that word trust out, I bring people back around to ethos as an easier, it's a less corrupted right now, I think, rhetorical area for people to be able to look at and think. So I'm like, you know, you can trust me. And I do this with all these, everybody I talk to, I'm like, you can trust me. Not for everything. You probably don't want to give me your, you know, credit card and that kind of stuff, but you can trust that I'm trying to do a certain thing for you. And I don't care what you vote for. I care about, can you think your way there? And can you talk? Can you look at the talk? And if I can get that, then they start to value ethos a little bit more. Like, even if you try to do an ethos war and say, hey, Biden's a better person than Trump, right? I've tried that a few times, and that they can't even hold on to that. But yeah, they can hold on to
that. You think that would be easy, that he's just universally known as a decent person.
Right.
And has so many testimonials from Republicans that he's just a decent person.
Yeah, he goes to church every week, has grandkids.
But once again, I think, you know, the Trumpian counter man there is ick. I was really enjoying having my indecency exposed and voiced here.
Yeah.
So, you know, once again, the recoil against political correctness and all of those moralisms is part of the
funny.
Yeah, we want the bad boy. We want the, you know, a certain group does. I'd say back to what you're saying, and I endorse it completely. just rhetoric 101 would suggest audience analysis and targeting one's audience. There are certain, you know, at this point in time, there's certain audiences that, you know, have a fundamental problem with reality. I mean, traditionally, these are the people that send wedding presents to people on soap operas and stuff. They just have a, you know, there is a category there. Sure. And there are people who are so inoculated in, you know, the function of the pulpit here in American religion as an ideological tool, that's pretty hard to assail. And I think for a certain segment of the population that's been consistent, they kind of may run hot and cold on conservative candidates. But that, once again, that's just sort of nullify those voters. You can't fundamentally, right, ideologically convert them. Too much inoculation there. And we, you know, so that would be one. But there is a certain group, and I think right now,
the digital big small brothers.
I usually remember to silence that. Yes, but the group that I think is going to be sort of at play in play here is really the labor group. That they are political. They do have investments. They will go back and forth and have gone back and forth. And so the Republicans are now targeting that group, and the Democrats had better. And so it really isn't the intelligentsia that has that much of a problem.
I would agree with that. And so, again, the more story susceptible groups. So, you know, if you're going to be on the liberal side and you want to do some winning, you know, write some really good stories, because conspiracies are pretty good stories.
You know, a commentator that I think has been on top of this for many years is Thomas Frank, the guy that wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? Mm-hmm. And if you look at his, he's done many lectures that are available on YouTube, and he's significantly, you know, targeted his commentary in these last few elections about why Democrats lost labor and how that is fundamentally. The other component there is motivating the poor. So it's not just labor, but, you know, the lower end of labor, right? Getting them to the polls, feeling that right, they have something at stake. And I think we saw more of that, although it may have been couched in race issues. We saw more of that in this last election. The sheer number of people who didn't vote in 2016 and the sheer number who did vote in 2020, it's a new ball game. So I think there are opportunities here.
Well, cool. We're over an hour again, as per usual, because rhetoric needs so much.
Needs that extra 15 minutes, huh?
It always, I don't know, to me, like I like learning in less structured ways. I like I said at the beginning, to ramble through things. And
well, I like not watching the clock, but
you know, but super fun. I like the useful stuff here, the very useful stuff, like the idea of trust and, you know, using that to break through some of this and understanding, you know, the power of even just basic rhetorical training would do a lot, I think, to help people protect themselves from this. I think those are both really...
Well, you've got a good project, Dan.
Really useful. Well, thanks. Thanks for being a part of it. This is...
Thank you.
I look forward to this every time. So
thank you very much.
So, well, that's us once again. That's been the Rhetoric Files, Rhetorician Interviews on the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Thanks again to David Payne for talking about propaganda. And get out there and persuade some people. They need it. We'll see you next time.